Support for this program is brought to you by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
From the studios of KUOM Radio K at the University of Minnesota, this is Culture Cube, the arts show that rocks. This week on Culture Cube, the paths of history.
Just a little stroke here or a little touch there can change the whole expression. I mean, it's something really fragile.
We also know that out there, there probably is a substantial number of students that aren't getting any care at all.
He says, well, we're going to go downtown tomorrow. We're going to buy you a guitar because you sound good. My old man said that. What a great guy.
Thank you for tuning in. I'm your host, Noel Clark. Through the many twists and turns in life, we all manage to write our own history. But that doesn't mean we have any control over how it plays out. Tonight on Culture Q, we take a look at some of the paths history can take. We've got a painter who records the stories of Holocaust survivors, a musician's sentimental memories of that first guitar, struggling students with a history of mental illness, and the songs played in a long-gone car stereo. It's Culture Q, and it starts right now. Some get into the business of guitars for the love of music. Others see it as a way to put their craftsman skills to work, making instruments as a way of life. At Hoffman Guitars in South Minneapolis, reporter Eric Schultz tells the tale of three Charlies, strung together by a life lived through guitars.
Charlie McGuire, a local musician, can tell you exactly about the very first guitar he ever got to play.
That was a Kwai guitar, K-W-A-I. And it was owned by my best friend's older brother, who was going into the Navy.
It was in the early 1960s, and a young Charlie McGuire had every intention of being a great musician. He just didn't have an instrument.
So I went to my best friend, who was also named Charlie, except we called him Chuck. And I said, did your brother take his guitar with him? He says, oh no, he's up at Great Lakes. He says, he's not gonna use guitar for 2 years. And I said, well, maybe I can borrow it. He said, oh yeah, that'd be great. So we went up in his room and got the guitar and brought it down, and I held the guitar in my hands, and I just knew it.
With almost a foresight of what his life will be, he knew that if he held a guitar, he would be able to play it.
And I held it in my hand, and I had no idea what to do next. So I said, well, I'm going to have to learn how to do this. But there were no guitar teachers where I grew up. So I went with my mother one day, and we were at the grocery store. And I said, I'm going to go in the drugstore for a second. So I went in the drugstore.
Looking around at a newsstand, a book caught his eye. Play the guitar in 30 minutes.
I said, that's... So I put down my 75 cents. I brought the book home. 3 months later, I played my first song. After that, when I played my first song finally from my family, my father came up to me and he said, where'd you get that guitar? And I said, oh, I borrowed it from Chuck's older brother. He says, it's not yours then. I said, no. He says, well, we're going to go downtown tomorrow. We're going to buy you a guitar because you sound good. My old man said that. What a great guy. And it was a sunburst.
Moving 10 years into the future in a different location, there was another person who was starting his own future with guitars, Charles Hoffman.
I built my first guitar in, it was the label inside of it says June 1970. And so I started it before then, obviously, but that's when it was finished. The business started about a year later, literally April 1st, 1971. And at the time, it was called Belleville and Hoffman.
His business partner, Rod Belleville, who was a local bluegrass musician at the time, was apprenticed to a local violin maker, Matthias Dahl, located in downtown.
Rod thought we should open up a shop, and neither of us knew much about repairing guitars, but nobody else knew anything about it, so we were ahead of the game, and there we were.
Listening to him talk about his shop, Charlie Hoffman does have to say that everything does have a certain personality, or in his words, it's a certain...
Characteristics, both tonal characteristics. It's characteristics having to do with feel, playability, sound, all of that is unique to every single guitar. And the way those things will fit into the needs, the ear, the hands of a given player is also going to be unique in every situation. So guitars have personality. You got to get married. I tell people to go around and play a lot of guitars. Eventually one will stand up and slap them upside the head and say, buy me, and that's the one you should get.
With such a colorful history in music, it's easy to see that the relationship between an artist and their instrument isn't just the artist playing something. The instrument is an extension of who they are. Charlie McGuire was very nice to play the song, and I'm here to play it for you.
Getting in the cow, shoeing in the barn, put it in the station, turn the radio on. Milk them all dry now, send them out again. Wait a month on the derby before the checkers come in. Up in the morning and the sun up dark, I'm going down the lane to bring my milk cows up. Got a horse and a jersey and a one-eyed steer. An old brown cow jumps fences like a deer. Dew's on the ground, my feet are wet. I got a light on my hand, hat on my head. Down to the pasture to get my herd. Just chewing their cud, looking at the birds. Getting in the cows, shooing in the barn. Put them in the station, turn the radio on. Milk them all dry now, send them out again. Wait a month on the dairy for the check to come in. Here's Charlie's guitar.
For Radio K, this is Eric signing out.
You know, a tourist say a cow's face is so fine.
For artist Felix de la Concha, it's not enough to just paint his subjects. He needs to know and remember them as well. He brought his latest project, Portraits with Conversations, to Minneapolis in order to interview 8 Holocaust survivors while listening to and recording their unique testimonies. Producer Amy Friedman has this story.
Think of the most important memory that you have. How would you pass this memory on to someone else? Would you tell a story?
I recognize the chief of Gestapo. I worked for him.
What about a memory that's difficult to hear? A memory like this one, of Robert Mendler's time in the Holocaust.
I was in camp. I lost my faith. I couldn't believe it. Where's the God? Where's the God?
We are ourselves the last generation that have this opportunity to have this direct testimony from the Holocaust survivors.
Artist Felix de la Concha came to Minneapolis to capture the memories of 8 Holocaust survivors. He did this in a unique way. De La Concha would sit down alone with each individual survivor and listen to their stories. And as he listens, he paints them, each sentence inspiring a new brushstroke.
The way that just a little stroke here or a little touch there can change the whole expression, I mean, it's something really fragile, let's say.
De La Concha records these sessions on video. When you watch them, his paintings seem so in tune with the survivor's testimony. It's almost like the artist isn't even there, like the story itself is painting the picture. In the video, De La Concha himself is not in the shot. You only see his hand painting to the beat of the testimony.
I'm very much under, without control of what I'm painting. The last portrait I did here, he was talking very, very fast, faster than usual, and there was something that, in a way, that could be seen in the video. The whole process is speeded the way I was approaching the portrait.
Okay, he put a mark on me I could never forget. My mom, how she cried with me. It bothers me today. You know, I talk about that.
Since intimacy is such an important part of these sessions, I wasn't allowed in on them to record. But this is De La Concha's own recording of his interview with Robert Mendler. Mendler spent 9 months in Birkenau.
On my boat. And I start to scream, a Gestapo, a chief Gestapo.
Professor Anna Forcinato at the University of Minnesota has heard a lot of stories like this.
I went with testimonial accounts, and working more and more with the visual representation of atrocities.
For her, the combination of the portrait with the testimony is key.
And the visual aspect of representation is not completely enough to tell a story, but at the same time, a testimony seems not complete. When we see a portrait, we don't know who that person is, but we do know, but we don't know the story. And now, with this project, we can all see or hear the story.
It's easy to drown in the sheer numbers of atrocities like the Holocaust. A portrait offers a way to understand these numbers. It is one moment in history that we can grab onto.
We can have the possibility of really listening, in this case, for 2 hours to a story of one human being that is telling the story of many.
But for Felix de la Concha, one of the most meaningful moments of an interview was realizing the stories he couldn't tell.
There is something that hasn't told to anyone but his wife, not even his children. He didn't tell to me either. Saying what he was not willing to say, it was something very, very moving.
Sometimes, the most important parts of a memory are the things we don't want to remember. For Culture Q, I'm Amy Friedman.
Thanks for listening to Culture Q. My name is Markita, and I'm joined in studio with Mike, and we are counting down the top 7 celebrity diplomats.
In wake of Dennis Rodman going over to North Korea, we thought this list would be appropriate.
Who does it make the most sense to send abroad first?
Okay, well, number 7 on the list is Ellen DeGeneres.
Ellen DeGeneres proved her role as a great guide in Finding Nemo.
Her talking to the whales really facilitated that whole resolution. She had Tom Cruise go nuts. And convinced Lance Armstrong that was Oprah Holmes.
Yeah, both of those. They're so different.
Maybe Oprah should be on this list of diplomats.
Nah. Our number 6 is Justin Timberlake.
Go ahead.
He's bringing sexy back to politics. And he's all dressed up in his suit and tie. So he's ready for all those meetings, all those photo ops.
He kept in sync together for a really long time. Probably way longer than it should have been. I think he was the glue there.
If he can get 4 other members of a band in sync with one another, think of what he could do with 4 other countries.
All right, number 5 on the list is Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert. It would be too partisan if just one of them went.
They're up on current events. They know what's going on.
And they're hysterical. Could you imagine one sitting on either side of like Netanyahu? He'd have nowhere to go. He'd be laughing, and then they'd bring up a good political point, and then he'd laugh some more. Things would get done.
Plus, I think America already believes that they are
they are diplomats for us. One of them should be the Secretary of State at this point. All right, moving on.
Number 4 is Rick Moranis.
Honey, I blew up a country. I see it now.
No, that so wouldn't happen because he's a genius. I mean, he played one as an inventor. So some of that must have rubbed off, you know, especially if he's like a method actor.
And he nursed Audrey 2 to health in Little Shop of Horrors. And he quit acting. So he's got all the time in the world at this point to be a diplomat.
All the time in the world to go save the world.
Exactly. Number 3 is America's sweetheart, Betty White.
Her time as the Golden Girl, as one of the Golden Girls.
No, just, you can be honest. She was the Golden Girl.
She really was, wasn't she?
Of the Golden Girls.
I mean, I liked Blanche, but
Dorothy was stuffy. Sophia.
Sophia.
Sophia. I love Sophia, but she was just a little on the old side.
Her and the Queen, Queen Elizabeth, would get along great.
They certainly would. And I don't care how mean or evil the dictator from another country could be. He's not going to look sweet old Betty White in the eyes and tell her we're going to war.
I don't know why this wasn't our defense strategy long ago. We need to show the world we're not big bad America. We're all just little Betty Whites.
Yes.
But someone else we'd be okay with representing us is Jennifer Lawrence.
She's a trip. What can I say?
She's proven lately that she's pretty down to earth.
Mm-hmm. Really, she has a good understanding of gravity. She
at
sure
a level
does.
No one else does. It wouldn't trip too many people up. She has us all falling for her.
Bad pun. And she's a mean shot with a bow and arrow. You wouldn't want to mess with her either. She'll pick you off from a ways away.
She volunteered to be the tribute in the Hunger Games. So we can expect her to sort of step up in the same way as a diplomat.
Dictators, stand by. She's not messing around.
She's not messing around, so maybe we should apologize for all those tripping jokes earlier.
Sorry, Jennifer.
It's all out of love.
All right, before we get in any more trouble with Jennifer Lawrence, number one on the list is our favorite kid president.
He got the nation agree on how to pronounce diabetes. I think his first foray into public health was a good stepping stone. And the next logical step, obviously, is to be a world diplomat.
He's too cute. Those cheeks, squishy cheeks. Kid's got a pretty sharp suit. I like it.
Politicians can agree on one thing. It's the importance of a good suit. This kid's got it.
We appreciate your efforts, Dennis, but we're going to change the lineup of celebrity diplomats just a little bit. But for everyone else, stay tuned for the rest of Culture Q.
Absolutely.
Though we go to school for different reasons, usually the goal is the same, to graduate. But as graduation gets closer, for some it creates a host of stressors that can cause or exacerbate mental illness. Reporter Alex Mertens investigates how sometimes the difficulties of mental illness only make things worse.
What does that sound like to you? That's right, they're seconds. Depending on where you are, those seconds might have completely different meanings. They might symbolize the time before the end of your lecture. They might symbolize the time until your next lecture. They might symbolize the time until you leave college altogether. Or maybe that's the time before that class you have to TA that you really don't want to go to because all the kids think they're so clever hiding their cell phones. And yes, I see you right there. Put it away. No, I don't care about your excuses. Come on, your parents are paying good money for you to be here. Regardless of their meaning, we can't escape them. And, like it or not, they are all drawing us towards one conclusion. That's right, graduation. Or, if graduation isn't really your thing, at least getting your diploma. Be that bachelor's or master's, or maybe even for those few lucky ones, their PhD. Congratulations, doctors. Yet this end of college signals one very, very pressing thing. What do you do next? And more importantly, how do these fears affect the students involved? I walked through some of these crowded halls and tried to get myself a few answers.
Okay, what makes me most nervous is getting a job after graduation, so yeah, that's my worst fear.
After I graduate, finding a job.
I'd say I'm most worried about what I'm going to plan on doing afterwards, which path I want to take.
Because you need to start finding a job, you have more responsibilities toward the society, not just yourself.
Well, that answers that question. What seems to be on the minds of students? Jobs. Getting them, keeping them, getting one that doesn't suck. It's a lot to go through, and a lot of stress that goes along with it. And that's even before you consider the academic requirements even to graduate. What effect does this have on the student rushing towards graduation? Does it have any effects, and how bad can they be?
At the point that they've chosen to seek out help, they're often at a point where their physical and emotional symptoms are at a point where that really becomes the kind of the first priority.
That was Dr. Gary Christensen, one of the chief medical officers at Boynton Health Services. Though he oversees many departments, one of them is the mental health clinic. He was good enough to give me a rundown of just what they look for.
For us to consider a diagnosis of depression, major depression, for example, which is a common diagnosis, has to be there for at least half a month and is associated with a number of other symptoms. One of them that might be present is just an inability to enjoy things that you used to enjoy before. Other symptoms tend to be more physically reflected, so inability to sleep or sleeping too much, low energy, extreme appetite or very low appetite, suicidal thoughts, feelings of hopelessness and despair.
The one inescapable thing about these symptoms is, in a way, some of them are kind of routine. Sleeping too much, eating too much, not sleeping enough, not eating enough. It all seems kind of standard for a lot of college students. However, it's not about the symptoms themselves. It's about how prevalent and how often they come up. The routine nature of some of these symptoms can lead to problems when trying to diagnose. More importantly, however, it might lead to some problems with the students even going into the mental health clinic. They might believe that they just haven't slept enough that day, or they're not hungry because of stress.
We also know that out there probably is a substantial number of students that aren't getting any care at all. For example, many studies have shown that for students with depression, probably 50% are not seeking any treatment. So the mental health issue is pretty substantial for this campus.
However, in the case of the University of Minnesota, those numbers have actually gone up.
If you compared our last year to 2004, we've seen a 41% increase in visits to the mental health clinic here at Boyne Health Service. Over 13,000 visits in the last year, and representing over 3,000 individual students.
The question then is, how many of these new or previous cases are graduates? According to a study published by the National Alliance on Mental Illness, 37% of students diagnosed with mental illness are between the ages of 18 and 22, with a further 26% between the ages of 22 and 26. No matter where you fall in that age range, most likely, you're thinking about graduation. And given that the study reported a 27% rate of depression and an 11% rate of anxiety, it's safe to assume that at least some of those are brought on by some of the extra stresses graduation heaps on top of college students' shoulders. Graduation and everything that follows is a terrifying prospect, even if it does taste like fear and hope and Diet Coke and rainbows. For Culture Q, this is Alex Mertens.
Much of recorded history is documented in books written by or about influential people. With that in mind, our question of the week this week is, if your autobiography had to be written today, what would the title be?
I think it would have to be called Red Bull and Jelly Beans.
Why is that?
Because that's the only way I can get all my work done.
Really, Ellie?
A great potential.
Be called, Greetings from the Multiverse.
The Rise and Fall of Michael Gould. Or, I Miss the 80s.
Can I think about it for a few minutes? Can that be the title?
It should be I Love Lucy, ghetto style.
I don't know. I'm a pretty happy person. But, you know, I've gone through stuff. So I think dandelions and daggers. Because my life has been mainly pleasant, like a dandelion. But obviously there are things that one has to overcome in life.
Like daggers?
Yeah, like daggers.
Beaches and bitches.
You can't say that on the radio.
Can't say that on the radio.
The Inferno.
Oh,
mine would be called... Hey, what up?
Think of some clever play on words that includes your name.
I'm not clever. I'm not clever. That's it.
Autobiography written today, what would it be called?
Think of your life so far.
Not done yet.
Still got time, but never quite as much as we need. Yeah. I love him. I love
I'm Ross Cable. I'm a DJ at Radio K, Saturdays from 3 to 6. And on this week's Soundscope, I'd like to talk about songs to listen to while driving. I grew up on a farm 15 or 20 minutes outside of the nearest town, so the moment I got my license, I was in my car all the time and wanted some music to listen to allow me to feel super cool while I was king of the world in my 98 Oldsmobile Intrigue. And I burnt a lot of CDs that had music for very specific purposes. Music to wake up to is very important, and for that, I had the first two tracks from the album Fantasy Black Channel by Late of the Pier. It starts with a stadium-ready guitar riff and perfectly transitions into this really awesome electronic song, but I burnt the CD wrong, so there was a 10-second gap of silence. So I had to be very awake to spin the knob at just the right moment to get the songs to play seamlessly into one another, and that was a great way to make sure that I was awake and alert. I also liked having a song in the car I could scream along with, whether I was, you know, on an abandoned highway, the only one there, or if you're in the middle of traffic, if you're screaming with something, it's pretty intense. You always feel a lot cooler. For that, I had, personally, the album Doolittle by Pixies, and when I went back home this Christmas and put this CD in my CD player in my car, I realized that the track Hey, I'd played it so much, I'd screamed along with it so often that it can actually no longer be played. It is scratched to the point of no return. Being in your car isn't always going to be awesome, and although you can't exactly plan for it with a soundtrack, you can have some music to place the blame on. For me, that song would be Rewind by Borrowed Beams of Light, which was playing when I slid off the road on some ice, broke up with a girl, and got my first speeding ticket. So even though I love this band to the extent that I own this album autographed by them, I can't listen to the song without thinking of these vehicular experiences. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, because it is in times like those when we find ourselves most in need of some soothing music. Finally, and I'm not just saying this because it's being broadcast over the radio, but while you're driving, you should listen to the radio, because you never know what kind of discoveries you'll be able to make. The perfect example of this for me is the song You Remind Me of Home by Ben Gibbard, which I had never heard until last summer when it came on the AM broadcast from this very station. It was just a really soothing song that allowed me to have a tranquil drive home and lyrically touched on a lot of things I had been thinking about at the time. So I immediately, of course, fell in love with it, and I never would have heard it without turning on that radio broadcast. For Culture Q, I'm Ross Cable. This has been my Soundscope. If you're driving, I hope you've discovered the perfect soundtrack for yourself, and I hope you keep an eye on the road.
That's our show. This week you heard from Amy Friedman, Markita Fornoff, Mike Potter, Alex Mertens, Eric Schulz, and Ross Cable. Producers for Culture Q are Mitch Skinner, Markita Fornoff, Amy Friedman, and Matt Curtis. Our culture coach is Sarah Lemanchek, and your host and managing editor is Noel Clark. You can find archives of our show on RadioK.org and listen live on the Radio K iOS app, available free at the iTunes Store. We'll see you next week. Support for this program comes from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.